So first week, roughly speaking, was operationalism and some, you know, big picture of what the problem in quantum theory is. Second week was some terms for realist models, non-locality, contextuality. We saw these are going to be features of any realist model within the framework that we set up. And now this week, we're going to go over a few different interpretations. De Broglie-Bohm will be the first. We'll cover collapse theories and many worlds. And on Wednesday, Chris Fuchs is going to tell you about revising probability theory to try to make sense of quantum theory. OK, so the de Broglie-Bohm interpretation goes back all the way to the early days of quantum theory. De Broglie, as you know, was working on, he was the father of wave-particle duality. And he had unlike Heisenberg, who took an operationalist approach to the theory, de Broglie was taking a realist approach, as was Schrodinger. So the idea was to use the analogy. In optics, we have wave optics and ray optics. And with that analogy, de Broglie thought, well, perhaps in particle theories, the rays of optics are like the particle trajectories, but there's also a wave that we can understand particle trajectories in terms of waves. And so he developed an interpretation based on that. It was rediscovered in the 50s by David Bohm. De Broglie was criticized for this interpretation by various people, including Pauli, and essentially gave up on it. Bohm rediscovered it and showed that ultimately it was shown that the objections were not right, and de Broglie re-embraced the theory, and since that time people have worked a lot on it. And also it was important because John Bell was looking at it as a counterexample to the claims by people like von Neumann and others that you couldn't build a hidden variable interpretation of quantum theory. And he came across Bohm's theory and realized that you could, you know, so there must have been something wrong with those no-go theorems. And very importantly, he noticed that the theory was non-local, and he wondered whether it might be that all attempts at a realist model of quantum theory would be non-local, and that ultimately led to Bell's theorem. So historically, it's very important.
So was Bell the one who first noticed the non-locality?
That's right. I'm sorry. You mean in the de Broglie-Bohm interpretation? Well, there's an interesting story there. I'm pretty sure Bohm recognized the non-locality. As to whether de Broglie recognized it, it looks as if he didn't. So there's a very interesting story which you can read in this new book called Quantum Theory at the Crossroads, which is by Valentini and Patrick Loupy. And it seems that de Broglie wrote down the theory and thought it was local. And embraced it for that reason. And Einstein wrote down a similar theory, recognized it was non-local, and abandoned it for that reason. So history might have been very different if de Broglie made a critical mistake at one point and seemingly didn't recognize it. And had he recognized it, he might not have proposed the theory at all. So maybe I'll come to it at some point in the development. OK, so let's launch into it. I'll start with giving you the de Broglie-Bohm interpretation for a single particle, and then we'll move on to many particles later. So what does it claim about reality? Well, the ontic state in this theory for a single particle consists of two things, the wave function, so the wave function is considered to be real, and a particle position. So it's what we called earlier a psi-supplemented theory. The wave function has the role of something real, but it's supplemented with something else, namely the position of a particle. So in red here would be the wave, and the particle would be the blue dot, moving off in some direction. So now you need evolution equations for those quantities. The first evolution equation is just Schrodinger's equation. So it postulates that the wave function evolves in the standard way for a single particle, kinetic term, potential term. And now it has to postulate an evolution for the particle positions as well. And that's the guidance equation. So what you do is you take the wave function in the position representation, you write it out in terms of amplitude and phase. Okay, so SRT is the phase of the wave function. And the velocity of the particle is determined by the gradient of the phase evaluated at the position of the particle. And divide that by m. So m times the velocity is the gradient of the phase. So really, the Bohmian particle's momentum is given by the gradient of the phase evaluated at its position. So that might look a bit strange at first, but you'll see that it's well motivated by other physics. And that's it. Okay, so that's what the theory claims is happening in reality for a single particle. That's real. This is how it evolves. So notice a couple of things. First of all, the Schrodinger equation, the evolution of psi, doesn't depend on any way on the positions of these Bohmian particles. You won't find zeta anywhere in this equation. However, the velocities of these Bohmian particles do depend on the wave function through the gradient of the phase. So you have action from the wave function on the particle, but no back action back on the wave function. So in that sense, it's unlike field theories that you've seen before. You know, one way you might be tempted to interpret this is, it's just, you know, matter interacting with a field. So the field propagates, and it pushes the matter around via some coupling. But there's a sense in which this field is very different. It suffers no back action. And the second thing is that the amplitude of this field, this wave, is totally irrelevant to the motion. So if I, you know, increase the weight in some region, it won't affect the phase, and therefore it won't affect the velocity. So unlike a regular field theory, where the amplitude might be important for how a particle moves, here this wave is more of a guiding wave. So it's more as if it transmits information to the particle to tell it how to move, information that's encoded in the shape of the phase dependence. So this is why this is called a guidance equation. The wave function is sometimes referred to as a guiding wave or a pilot wave in the de Broglie-Bohm interpretation. And in fact, this interpretation and others like it are sometimes called pilot wave theories, where the role of the wave function is to pilot things around. Okay. So I want to show you another way of thinking about those equations, which might make them look a little bit more familiar. And for that, it's necessary to rewrite the Schrodinger equation slightly differently. So I've decomposed the wave function into amplitude and phase. And then if you rewrite the Schrodinger equation in terms of R and S, and you split it up into two equations for the real and the imaginary part, you get this and this. Here, Q corresponds to this expression, which is referred to as the quantum potential. And you'll see in a moment why it's referred to as a potential. So this is a sort of lengthy calculation, not very difficult, but I think it'd be useful if you did this in tutorial. So I'm not going to do it here in lecture. But you'll see that these expressions are useful for various derivations. And this, incidentally, does it remind anyone of anything? This is analogous to the Hamilton-Jacobi equation, so a particular way of doing analytic mechanics, where S is Hamilton's principal function. And there are various proponents of the de Broglie-Bohm interpretation who say that the appropriate way to think about this theory is as a generalization of a Hamilton-Jacobi approach to classical physics. So if you thought that was the fundamental approach, then you might modify it in certain ways and get quantum mechanics. Okay, so the other way of thinking about these equations is as a Newtonian type of theory. So this is the Newtonian form of the particle dynamics. Rather than looking at the equation for the velocity of the Bohmian particles, you look at the equation for their acceleration. So m times the acceleration of the particles is just minus the gradient of the external potential v evaluated at the position of the particles, and another term, minus the gradient of this q. So that was the quantum potential from the last slide, this thing here. And so you see that in the in a Newton's second law equation, it appears in exactly the same way as the external potential does. But it depends now on the wave function through the amplitude of the wave function, r, or the absolute value of the amplitude of the wave function. So what it looks like is a modification of Newtonian mechanics, where in addition to the regular external potentials, you have this new potential due to the wave function. And again, note that if I change the amplitude, you know, if I double R, then it cancels out, and it makes no difference to the quantum potential. So again, the quantum potential effectively encodes information about the shape of the wave function. And so it can be thought of as piloting the particle. OK, so let me convince you of this fact, that you can rewrite the equations in this way. All right, so the first thing we do is we take the real part of the Schrodinger equation, which is the expression inside the square brackets set equal to 0. And we operate with the del operator on it. And so the first term is clearly just d by dt del s. The second term, you just have to use some identities from vector calculus to see that it's just the gradient of s dot del outside of del s. And then we move the del q plus v to the right-hand side of the equation. OK. And now compare that to what happens if you take the time derivative of the guidance equation. So this was the guidance equation. The velocity of the Bohmian particle is given 1 over m times the gradient of the phase. So I take the time derivative. That gives me the acceleration on the left. And now here, I have a time dependence directly on the phase. So that's the time dependence that's inherited from the wave function. But I also have a time dependence in that I'm supposed to evaluate that at the position of the particle. And the position of the particle is changing over time. And so a full time derivative is given by the partial time derivative plus the velocity of the particle dot del acting on grad of s. And now that looks a lot like the left-hand side of this equation. And in fact, if you use the guidance equation again, you realize that this is just the velocity of the particle, which is grad s. So it's precisely the left-hand side of this equation. Therefore, I can set this equal to the right-hand side, and I get my Newtonian form of the dynamics. OK. So there it is again. Now, it might seem that, OK, well, then we can just think of this as another second-order theory like classical mechanics, and you know, the only change in the world is this quantum potential. But that's not quite right. Does anyone see another difference between de Broglie-Bohm interpretation and Newtonian physics? It has to do with freedom of initial conditions. That's true. So you have not just the particle positions as you would in a classical theory, but also this wave function. Good point. There's another difference in the initial conditions having to do with the particles. Yes?
So, like, since the position actually obeys the first order equation, you don't get to specify both the momentum and the position?
The momentum and the, yeah. You don't get to specify the momentum and the position because the momentum is fixed by the position. Exactly. So the dynamics are fundamentally first order because the velocity of the particle is fixed by the position of the particle and by the wave function. You don't get to freely specify it as you would in a Newtonian theory. So although you can write down these equations and observe the analogy with Newtonian mechanics, the theory is fundamentally different because you don't have the freedom of specifying the velocities. And if you want, you can ignore this way of doing things and just calculate the velocities in terms of the positions and do everything in this first order form. Yes, Michael.
The conserved energy depends only on the wave function.
You can define a Bohmian energy, which involves the kinetic energy of these Bohmian particles, for example. But in general, it doesn't correspond to the expectation value of the Hamiltonian. So you have to be careful in this theory to distinguish between quantities that are defined in terms of the Bohmian particles and the standard quantum observables. So when you say energy,
mean by energy, I mean the thing that's conserved in particle reactions.
The thing that's
conserved in particle reactions.
Well, if you mean the you know, is the expectation value of the Hamiltonian, you know, the quantum expectation value of the Hamiltonian, is that conserved? There is an expression in this theory which will correspond to the expectation value of the Hamiltonian, and it'll involve not just the kinetic energies of the Bohmian particles, but a term involving the wave function. And that's probably what you were asking. Is there some intrinsic dependence on the wave function in that?
No, I'm just a different kind of question. So let's say you have a hydrogen.
Yes, we're going to get to that example, hydrogen atom. Do you want to wait till we get there? Yeah, why don't you postpone and then ask it again when we get to that point? Okay. All right, so now the second element of the theory that you need to know is what's the distribution over Bohmian particles, right? So we postulated this extra supplementary degree of freedom. But because it was a deterministic theory, I didn't mention that explicitly, but those evolution equations were entirely deterministic. If you specify the wave function and the position of the Bohmian particle, nothing is uncertain. If you knew that Bohmian position, you'd be able to, you know, predict everything that happens. There would be no room for the unpredictability of quantum theory. And so it seemed clear that you need to introduce some uncertainty. You do it epistemically. So you say everything is objectively deterministic, but there's some uncertainty as to the position of the Bohmian particle. So if you have perfect knowledge of psi, which we assume, you know, if you do a preparation procedure associated with psi, you can know what psi is, then what's postulated by this interpretation is that you have limited knowledge of the Bohmian particle. If this is the probability that the particle is within d zeta of zeta, then this is the postulate, that the distribution is given precisely by the modulus squared of the wave function. Right, so if you have a wave function that's peaked over here, then you're saying, well, what you know is that the Bohmian particle is with that probability distribution likely to be in this region. Yes, Russ.
So in the classical limit, you would know very well the standard distribution. Like you would know this probability distribution very well. That's why we don't see these effects in the classical limit.
Well, in the classical limit, you have, you know, coarse graining. So you're not learning position to within a bar. You're only asking for position to within some coarser. And so you might find that, you know, within your, say you have a bin size, the entire support of the wave function could fall there, and you could say, well, it's definitely in this bin. So in that sense, you could have a well-defined coarse grained position. Yes,
Eric? I guess to clarify, is it accurate to say that the classical limit in this interpretation happens when your rows are like very sharply peaked?
Well, you can have a kind of classical limit via Ehrenfest's theorem. So, you know, Ehrenfest's theorem says that if you have wave packets that are, you know, for which the potential varies slowly on scales corresponding to the width of those wave packets, then the wave packet basically stays narrow and bounces around like a classical particle. So certainly you can have that same kind of classical limit here. All your particle positions will be confined to an area that moves around like a classical particle. But in general, the Ehrenfest theorem is not enough. If you have chaotic dynamics, for example, you find that very quickly your wave function spreads out. So people have discussed the classical limit of Bohmian mechanics. They've pointed out that in certain regimes, the quantum potential goes to zero. So in that sense, it approaches a classical theory where you have a distribution of particle positions. But each of those particle positions evolves classically. So I think that's the better analogy. There's an analogy between the distribution of particle positions and a Liouville distribution, which is obeying purely classical equations of motion. Now, an important fact about the standard distribution is that if you postulate it at one time, it follows that it's going to hold at all other times by virtue of the nature of the dynamics. So let me convince you of that. I mean, it's clear that this is important because if you postulate it at one time and then the dynamics made it not hold at another time, then you'd have some preferred time wherein it held. So the first thing to note is that the velocity field, you can define a velocity field for the ensemble of particles. And it's just given by the gradient of the phase over the mass, as we said before. And therefore, I can define a current density. So this is the density of particles in my ensemble. This is the velocity field. So this is the current density. And then I can appeal to conservation of probability. So it's deterministic law of evolution. So the number of particles, well, in this case, it's just one particle. That's not going to change. It's going to remain one particle. And so if at a particular region there's a change in the probability, then that's due to a divergence of the current density. So I just plug in now the expression for the current density here. So that just gives me the divergence of rho times the velocity field, which is the gradient of the phase. OK, so now I compare that to the imaginary part of the Schrodinger equation, which I had a few slides back, and which you'll work out in tutorial. So the imaginary part of the Schrodinger equation looked like this. And you'll see immediately that it looks a lot like this equation, where r squared is playing the role of rho. And this gradient of r squared del s over m looks just like that term. If I move it to the right-hand side of the equation, it picks up a negative sign. The difference is that rho is replaced by r squared here. So the point is that if at one time rho is equal to r squared, then the right-hand sides are going to look the same if I move this to the right-hand side. And so it tells me that d rho dt and dr squared dt are going to be exactly the same. And so the difference between rho and r squared, d by dt of that difference is 0. So if you know that they start the same, well, they can't evolve to be different because that time derivative is 0. So the standard distribution has this nice property. And if I'm not mistaken, some recent work from a few years back showed that actually it's the only distribution that has that property of being invariant under time translation. Yes?
The only distribution on this interpretation.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
So the analogy with optics makes it sort of easy to picture how the wave might guide around the particle, and this makes a little bit of sense. But it's sort of weird that the wave function both guides the dynamics of the particle and controls how much you know about it. Is
yes.
that a good way to think about why that? Is there like an analogy like there is for
optics? Well, so I think that's a situation that's different from an optics, the fact that the wave function plays this dual role. And various people have pointed out that that's an uncomfortable situation. How can it be that on the one hand, you're postulating this thing to be a real dynamical entity that pushes things around, and on the other hand, it's supposed to describe your initial knowledge? You know, why should it have those two completely different roles? So some have defended that dual role. And one notable response to it is the one by Anthony Valentini, where he says, well, we're going to abandon its role as defining what you know about the position of the particle. We're just going to say it doesn't do that. But it turns out that it ends up doing it in a coarse-grained sort of way. So what Valentini and others have been able to show is that if you have a particle guided by some pilot wave, then no matter what your starting distribution is, if that dynamics is sufficiently mixing, what happens is that the concentration of particles comes to reflect the profile of that wave function. So apparently in fluid dynamics, if you have a velocity field that's very mixing, the concentration will also come to reflect what that velocity field is on a coarse-grained scale. And so what these guys are able to show is that no matter what your starting distribution is, if your dynamics is sufficiently mixing, on a coarse-grained scale, rho will come to reflect psi squared. And so it's a bit like the H theorem in statistical mechanics. So if you're uncomfortable with that dual role, there is that sort of response. But it also means that you can imagine non-standard distributions. You can say, well, if the mixing hasn't occurred yet, then there's a distribution. I can imagine a distribution that doesn't reflect the quantum case. And if that's true, then we should see violations of quantum mechanics for matter that isn't in a standard distribution state. And so Anthony Valentini has done a lot of work on what would we see if this theory were true. And note that in that sense, you know, that's a really good example in my mind of how an interpretation can lead you to novel predictions. So I often hear people say, oh, well, this is just an interpretation of quantum mechanics, and so that's just philosophy, that's just metaphysics. What I'm interested in is alternatives to quantum mechanics, or you know, something beyond quantum mechanics. But interpretations may give you a particular way of thinking about the theory, which ultimately perhaps leads you to novel predictions. So I never like this distinction anymore between interpretation versus novel theory. It just blends into one. I mean, interpretations lead to novel stuff. And so we should just think of them as on the same footing. Good. All right, so we get to the hydrogen atom. So I'm going to go through some examples of what de Broglie-Bohm actually predicts occurs in various situations. So if you look at the 1s orbital of the hydrogen atom, it's a spherically symmetric wave function. And also because it has no angular momentum, ultimately the phase factor has no spatial dependence at all. If I had another orbital, then I might have an e to the I m phi term, and so there would be some spatial dependence to the phase factor. But for this sort of thing, there isn't. And so if I look at the guidance equation, it asks me to evaluate the gradient of the phase. And if the phase is constant over space, then that gradient is zero. And so it says the velocity of the particles are zero. So the distribution, you know, what I know is that they're distributed with a profile corresponding to the 1s wave function, so centered around the origin and falling off. But their velocity is zero. So they're just sitting there in space. You know, if this is the proton and the electron, the relative separation of the electron to the proton is just stationary. So in this case, a stationary state really is stationary. These things are just suspended there, not doing anything at all, which is a bit of a funny picture, but this is what de Broglie-Bohm predicts. Now, there was Michael, you had a question about the hydrogen atom. Now would be the time to ask it.
Yes. And that has nothing to do with the kinetic or potential energy of the bohmian particle.
That's right. I mean, it has something to do with it. But if I wrote down expressions for the energy of a particle that was in one of these orbitals, it would not necessarily correspond to the energy eigenvalue.
So, for example, in the 1s, you just prove that the particle is stationary.
Right. So, for example, the kinetic term is clearly zero in that case. Yeah. Well, its energy depends in a complicated way. The energy that you measure depends in a complicated way on both the position of the bohmian particle and on the wave function.
Okay.
And so that's the trick, that you can sort of, you can smuggle in as much information as you want of regular quantum mechanics through the dependence on the wave function, because the wave function is taken to be real. But you'll see that, so it depends on what measurement.
I more or less have to say,
yep.
The wave function entirely determines the energy, and the position of the bohmian particle is irrelevant to the energy.
No, it's really a mixture of the two, and a funny combination. Sorry?
Are you going to write the
formula? Why don't I don't remember it offhand, and I wasn't planning on presenting today, but I could do so next time. Yeah.
So if the, going off of that, if the wave function determines the position, then doesn't the wave function just by itself determine the energy?
Well, the wave function guides the position, so it determines the velocity. But it's independent of the position. So I can change the position without changing the wave function. And the only constraint it really implies is that if you believe in the standard distribution, it says that the relative likelihood of different positions should be given by the profile of the wave function.
I just want to ask you another question.
Yes.
So let's say you're in the 2D state.
Yes.
And you radiate a photon, you make a transition to the 1s state.
Mm-hmm.
Is the position of the Bohmian particle determined by the position of the 2p state, or does it end up in the correct distribution for the 1s state?
So just repeat that last bit. Does it end up?
So you started out with the 2p state.
Yes.
And there was a distribution of the positions of Bohmian particles given by the square of the 2p
state. Yep.
It now radiates a photon.
Yes.
Is the particle in the same place?
No, it'll undergo very interesting dynamics. The particle will change in the process of radiating. I'll come to an example that's almost exactly like the one you'll see, and it will change its position, and only at the end of the day will it become stationary again. All right, good. So this is the simplest example. Now let me talk about cases where I have superposition of different wave functions. This will be important for further examples. So in the de Broglie-Bohm interpretation, people often talk about different waves, right? So this set, the sum of terms can be thought of many different waves of the decomposition. And it's important whether what wave the Bohmian particle is found in. So if the position of the Bohmian particle is in the spatial support of the jth wave, then we say that the jth wave is occupied. And if it's not in the spatial support of the jth wave, then we say the jth wave is empty. So if you imagine a superposition of wave functions corresponding to, say, you know, wave packets in different areas, then the Bohmian particle is definitely somewhere. And if those guys don't overlap, then, you know, this one will be occupied and the others will be empty. Is it a question? Yes. No? Oh, sorry. All right, so that's this example. If only one wave, say the kth wave, is occupied, then it turns out things really simplify in terms of the dynamics. It turns out that the guidance equation then depends only on the kth wave, only on psi k, and not on the rest of the wave function. Yes?
Usual ordinary quantum mechanics is the support of two waves will have intersection.
The correspondence to, say,
so the superposition in normal quantum mechanics and superposition.
Yes.
Is the correspondence, is the analog of superposition something like two sides have non-zero intersection?
I think I see what you're saying. To a certain extent, the concept of orthogonality is not so relevant to de Broglie-Bohm theory. What's really important often is disjointness in position space, right? So the different energy eigenfunctions of an atom are orthogonal in the Hilbert space, but they're not disjoint in physical space. And that will make a big difference in this theory, whereas two wave packets are in different regions really are destroying physical space. So yes, in that sense, there's an analogy between regular orthogonality and disjointness. Okay, so let me. This is very important for understanding measurement theory and de Broglie-Bohm interpretation and many other things. So let me go over why the guidance equation depends only on the kth wave. All right, so consider a case where the wave function can be written as two terms. And the amplitudes of those terms I'm going to absorb into the definitions of psi A and psi B. So psi A and psi B are not normalized wave functions. Now, I'm interested in the modulus of the amplitude of psi and its phase. So I call those R and S. And I want them written in terms of the amplitudes and phases of psi A and psi B. So I write those out explicitly. And so now you can ask, well, what sort of function of these four quantities on the right is R. So that's a calculation that's pretty familiar. If I look at R squared, it's just the regular interference expression, right? So I have an RA squared and RB squared, and then I have a cross term, which depends on the phases of the two. So that's just what, you know, if you asked what's the probability of finding a particle at a certain position, it would just be given by this expression. It's the probability of finding it at that position given that it was psi A, plus the probability given that it was psi B, plus interference. The expression for the gradient of the overall phase is much more complicated. And I'm not going to try to derive it. I'm going to show it to you. And then I'm going to show how it simplifies in the case where psi A and psi B are non-overlapping. So this is it. It has a 1 over r squared out the front, and then it has all these expressions inside. So go to the case where rA and rB are approximately 0. So that means psi A and psi B are basically disjoint in physical space. Well, then this term drops out, and these two terms drop out as well. And furthermore, if you look at r squared, this term is gone. So this leading term, 1 over r squared, is just given by 1 over rA squared plus rB squared. So I have this, and the gradient of the phase now has this much simpler expression governing. Good. Yes? Because if RB is close to 0, then its gradient will also be 0. If the entire region here. I'm sorry?
It could definitely oscillate very fast. So you have to add some assumption.
I think you do need a stronger assumption here that effectively it's not some funny set wherein this is zero, but rather some region of space that it's uniformly zero over. I think that's true. So I probably should have been more careful specifying exactly what this assumption is. It's the assumption that we're going to need in most applications, the idea that, you know, there's some wave function over here and the particle somewhere in this region, and some wave function over here, which is empty. Okay, so now if you ask, well, how does a, say, particle A move if the wave function is psi A plus psi B, but psi A and psi B are such that their supports are essentially disjoint? Well, it's just, you know, the regular guidance equation. I'm sorry. Did I say particle A? That was a slip of the tongue. We only have one particle here. There's just one particle, and its wave function has two terms, A and B. So forget what I said about particle A. We ask, how does that one particle move? It's just given by the guidance equation. And now here's the key. And when I look at the gradient evaluated at the position of the particle, zeta, that will pick out either RA or RB, because these things are essentially disjoint. So one of these two terms is going to be close to 0. So if zeta happens to lie in the support of psi A, then this term will be small, this term will be small, the RA squares will cancel, and I'll just get the gradient of SA over the mass. Whereas if zeta is in the support of psi B, I'll just get a term of this form. So that's what I was trying to prove, basically that only the, so for the purposes of knowing how this particle moves, it's enough to know psi A if the Bohmian particle is in the support of psi A. And I don't need to know anything about psi B, except for the fact that it's disjoint. And the guidance equation will only depend on psi A. So if you have this disjointness property, then the dynamics really simplifies. Yes?
If there's some like wave function around, you could always sort of like artificially write it as like a piece that's around where the particle is, and then the rest of it.
Yep.
So is that kind of saying that like the wave function, like the particle is only influenced by like the local wave function?
That's right.
So like that bit of the theory is local, but the non-locality has to do with like the boundary conditions or something like that.
Well, when we get to multiple particles, that's where you'll see the non-locality. But here, it's a question of interference. If you have two parts of the wave function that sort of don't overlap in space, but at some later point in time they do start to overlap, then all of a sudden the nature of psi B can become important, because it'll change how the particle moves when it reinterferes with psi A. So here it, does that make sense? That for a while, you know, psi A might be the only thing that's important because psi B is disjoint. But if they overlap again in the future, then psi B becomes important again.
For example, in the double slit experiment.
For example, in the double slit experiment, exactly. And I'm going to show that example explicitly. So hold on to your question until we get to the two particle case, because I'll talk about non-locality, and then we'll see if it clarifies things or whether it's still unclear. All right. Here's the double slit experiment. So first of all, you know, so I'm imagining I have a wave function which is equal amplitude of passing through either slit. And what I've drawn here are the Bohmian particle trajectories. So if you lay down positions of the particles according to the probability measure, like the size square probability measure, and then you evolve those particle positions forward, this is what you see. Okay, so remember, it's just a double slit, and then there's free empty space after that. There's no potential anywhere in this place. Oh. Okay. So you would have expected classically just rectilinear motion in this region, and you don't have it in de Broglie-Bohm theory because the wave function sets up this quantum potential which can make interesting dynamics for the particles. Here's another thing you can notice, which is that prior, so you have a psi A and a psi B here, which don't interfere until a certain point. And before they interfere, the Bohmian particles that are in this region only see the wave function here. So this is exactly what you'd see if you just had a single wave function coming through a single slit. It would just disperse in this way. So it doesn't see the other wave function until they start overlapping. And so you then get an interference pattern between those two wave functions, and that leads to an interesting quantum potential, or equivalently, a non-trivial guidance equation, where now the particles start moving in interesting ways, which ultimately leads them to focus on the screen in an interference pattern. Yes, Chris?
Do those lines ever cross then? They never cross.
Can anyone see a reason why the lines should never cross? Eric?
I mean, you know, in dynamical systems, right? Like if two trajectories meet at any point and they remain the same from then on, they have to. Like what we have here is like, psi defines the dynamical system. Mm-hmm. The particles just obey that dynamical system. And if, and it's also reversible, I believe. Yes. That's it. If two things coincide at any time, they have to be the same at all later times. And
they could have different velocities, right? They could cross, have different velocities.
Isn't it first order dynamics?
That's the key, which is probably what you were going to say. The key is that this, unlike the classical theories you're accustomed to, is first order, which means that the velocity is determined by the particle position and the wave function. And so if two particles crossed, they would have exactly the same Bohmian position, which, according to the theory, would mean they would have to have exactly the same Bohmian velocity, and thereafter they would behave in precisely the same way. And furthermore, you can't imagine two things crossing. You know, they always have to avoid one another. Yes? So what happens if
R equals to zero?
R equals to zero. So that would be a problem if a Bohmian particle found itself in a region with R equals to zero, because the phase would become undefined or perhaps discontinuous. And you know, maybe it could pick up infinite velocities or something. But it turns out you can prove a property called flow regularity, which is that if you're in the standard distribution, such that your probability of being at a node of the wave function starts out at zero, then you will never flow into a region that assigns probability zero. You'll always stay outside of it because the standard distribution is maintained over time.
So for a double slit experiment, there are nodes in the region where the two wave functions interfere. And you say the particles are already always repelling?
Yeah. Like these points here. Yeah. The dynamics is such that the particles, if initially they're outside those regions, they will never end up there. So that's not a problem. Yes?
So that where you have that initial delta where they meet, mm-hmm. It looks like there's a ripple that's spreading out down. So that's...
This, you mean?
Right.
This ripple here?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's how you get the interference at the screen then, is it all has to propagate from where the trajectory is, or not me, obviously, because we just discussed that, but
yeah.
Where they almost meet.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, this is, in a sense, a limited set of trajectories. I could keep drawing more trajectories.
Oh, yeah.
And the wave function, you know, it just gets smaller out in this region, but it dies off. So, you know, as long as, you know, so the wave function comes along here, and it essentially sets up interference with this wave function in the region where it has some significant amplitude, which is basically a line that goes along here. So from there on, you have interference. So anyways, it's very pretty. For a single particle, at least, it's an extremely natural response to Bohmian mechanics. It says, okay, so we have these particles, we only ever detect them at one place, and we detect them as interference patterns. What could possibly be going on? Well, maybe there's a wave and a particle. The wave is pushing the particle around such that it acquires the same sort of pattern that the wave has, but there's only one particle, therefore it's only detected at one spot. That's the kind of picture that you can have for a single particle system. That sort of picture fails for many particles. So although what I just told you sounds great, unfortunately, you can't have it in general. Okay, so you can look at other examples. So here's an example of transmission through a barrier, potential barrier. So you have a wave packet. Here are the particle trajectories for that wave packet. The wave function evolves in such a way that some of it's transmitted, some of it's reflected. The Bohmian trajectories, some of them, the leading ones, go through, and the trailing ones are reflected. So there's a matter of fact for every possible Bohmian position, you know, whether it ends up through the barrier or on the same side as it came. Here's an example of a beam splitter. So if I have a wave packet that's in a coherent superposition of coming into these two input ports of a beam splitter, then it goes, the wave packet goes into coherent superposition of coming out the two output ports. And each Bohmian particle essentially either reflects or transmits. If this is a 50-50 beam splitter, then basically all these trajectories come back and all these trajectories reflect off the top. If it's not 50-50, then what you find is that some of the top trajectories are going to make a transition. And so what you're going to end up with is fewer trajectories on the bottom and more trajectories on the top. But again, you can never have crossing trajectories, so you always have to respect this this fact, the non-crossing principle. Yes?
So that would mean that the particles which seem to be transmitted through them are not actually, but they would cause particles on the bottom to go?
You mean in the case where more amplitude comes out the top than the bottom? Is that what you're interested in? In that case, you would have two sorts of particles. You'd have the particles that were already on top and stayed on top, and then the particles that used to be on the bottom and have now come out on top. So you can't, you know, one way you could have imagined having, you know, 50% come out up and 50% come out down is if some of the ones from the bottom went to the top and some from the top went to the bottom. But unfortunately, that would involve crossing, and so it's forbidden in the year.
Well, that's what I'm just trying to figure out.
Yeah. Okay, so let's move on to the many particle case. We're almost out of time. We'll have to continue a lot of stuff tomorrow. So for many particles now, you have the Arontic state is the wave function on the configuration space of two particles. So remember, a wave function needn't be a product state, so it's not necessarily the form psi 1 R1, psi 2 R2. It could be entangled. It's defined on the configuration space, not on physical space. So you can't think of it anymore as a wave propagating in physical space. So here are, say, two axes for particle 1, two axes for particle 2. The wave function is defined on that space. And then you have a particle position for each of your two particles. So these guys really do live in physical space. Equivalently, if I want, I could write them as a single point in the configuration space, which tells you, you know, where particle 1 and where particle 2 are. And then you can say, well, what are the evolution equations? Again, you just have Schrodinger's equation for the two particle wave function, standard, you know, kinetic terms, potential term, standard. And now you have a guidance equation for each one of your two particles, which is given in terms of the gradient of the variable associated with particle 1 of the total phase function, evaluated at the positions of particle 1 and particle 2. And the velocity for the second particle is given by the gradient with respect to the second particle position of the total phase, evaluated at the Bohmian positions for the particles, where now the total phase is just, you know, the phase of the entire wave function. And that's it. So now, you know, it's the natural generalization of the single particle theory. And clearly, I could generalize it to any number of particles in this way. Okay, so let's in the last couple of minutes, let's consider what happens for a product state, you know, the simplest kind of state for two particles. Well, this is what the amplitude and phase decomposition of each of those wave functions is. So the total phase is just now, you know, the sum of the exponents. So it's the sum of the phase for the first and the second particles' wave functions. And what that means is that when I look at the velocity for the first particle position, it's just the gradient with respect to the first particle's position of the total phase. But that splits up into these two terms. And the gradient of this guy is 0. So it's just the gradient of the phase of the first particle. And it's irrelevant what the position of the second particle is. So I can just evaluate it at the position of the first particle. So it looks just as if the first particle were in the state phi 1. Its guidance equation depends only on phi 1. And it doesn't care about the second particle at all. And of course, you have the same thing for the second particle. Its guidance equation depends only on its wave function and not at all on the first particle's wave function. So in this case, the two particles evolve independently. And so it's local, right? Especially if these two particles are far away. The evolution of this guy doesn't depend in any way on either the wave function or the position of the other particle. And you can see this also in terms of quantum potentials, if you want. The quantum potential actually breaks up into a sum of the quantum potentials for each particle. But if they're entangled, then things are not so simple. Suppose you have your Bohmian particle positions confined entirely in one of these waves. So suppose these J terms correspond to different waves. And the Jth wave is occupied in that case. And for all the ones that it's not in the support, those waves are considered empty, just as in the single particle case. We have this distinction. And so the particularly nice case is if only the Kth wave is occupied. If only one of them is occupied, then only that term of the wave function influences the dynamics. And because that term of the wave function is a product state, they will evolve independently. So that's nice. But in general, that doesn't happen. In general, you don't just have one wave occupied. If you have an interference experiment, you can have many of those waves occupied. And in that case, the dynamics of one particle does come to depend on the dynamics of the other. And you have failure of local causality in that case. So I have an example for this, but I've just gone over my 50 minutes. So should I finish with this example or just finish now? It'll probably take us another 3 minutes or 4 minutes. Is that all right? OK. So it's similar to the example Michael was asking about. Here, I imagine I have two electrons, and they're in this wave function here, which is entangled. So chi A and chi B, the different wave functions for the second electron, correspond to essentially the ground and first excited states of a harmonic potential. So that's chi A, and the green is chi A, and the red is chi B. And the first electron, the terms of this wave function, have it either in phi A or phi B, which correspond to wave packets traveling at different velocities. So phi A is traveling at a higher velocity than phi B. So roughly speaking, you can imagine that maybe there was some collision such that the low energy state of electron 2 is correlated with the high energy state of electron 1. And the high energy state of electron 2 is correlated with the low energy state of electron 1. And they're entangled in this particular way. OK, so that's the example. And the question is, what do the dynamics of the Bohmian particles look like? OK, so suppose, well, here are the two terms for the green and the red, just to be clear. Suppose these are the positions of the Bohmian particles, zeta 1 and zeta 2. OK, so what can you say about empty waves and occupied waves for this total wave function. Sorry? Exactly, yeah. In fact, the entire term of the two-particle wave function is empty because phi b is empty, right? So all I needed was disjointness with respect to one of these variables to get disjointness overall, right? The fact that phi a times phi b is 0 tells me that this times this is also 0. And so the fact that this guy is assigned 0 by zeta 1 means any assignment zeta 1 comma zeta 2 also is 0. We'll make this 0. So it tells me that the first term of this two-particle wave function is the only occupied term. And so this is the one that's going to govern the dynamics. So now if I look at the Bohmian position of system 2, so that's zeta 2, and I say, how does it get involved? It depends, now because this is a product state, it depends only on chi A. And chi A is real. It has no complex amplitude at all. So how does it going to evolve? Dispersively? What leads you to say that?
Schrodinger equation is basically the dispersion equation with the complex amplitudes.
Well, so here, imagine, I haven't drawn it in, but imagine there's a harmonic potential that electron 2 is sitting in. So I haven't turned the potential off. It's in this ground state of that potential. So if I turn the potential off, it would disperse. But I'm imagining the potential's still on. So the wave function, chi A, is not changing in time. It's just staying put as the ground state. Chris?
Should be stationary because the gradient, there's no phase gradient.
Right.
The velocity is proportional to the phase gradient.
Yeah, it's like the situation that we saw for the 1s orbital of the hydrogen atom. The velocity of the particle depends on the gradient of the phase. Here we've got a wave function for which there is no gradient of the phase. So it's just going to stay put. So zeta 2 just stays put where it is. It doesn't move at all. So let me illustrate that. So that's the guidance equation for zeta 2. I guess I should have flashed that up. That made it clear. And so this is the picture, that the distribution of zeta 2 is given by the sum of those two guys, the first and the second, right? So that's the overall probability for zeta 2. We imagined it started here, and it stays there because, well, there's no gradient to the phase. So that's all it does. Okay, and now, you know, particle 1 has gone and flown off, you know, maybe arbitrarily far away. And so if it was a local theory, zeta 2 could not depend anymore on what happened to particle 1. But suppose now that we choose to put a wall or a mirror here, very far away from that guy. So there it is. And that's going to cause the leading wave function to reflect back and ultimately re-interfere with the slower one. Okay. And now we're going to get to a situation where both waves become occupied again. So here it is. It's reflected. The Bohmian position for this guy is just traveling along with the wave packet. And now the Bohmian position lies in the support of both those wave packets. So no longer do I have any empty waves. Both of these waves are now occupied. And both of them can start influencing the dynamics again. And so when you work it out, you find that zeta 2 no longer depends just on chi A. It now depends on the whole wave function. These guys here have complex amplitudes because they're traveling wave packets. And so the gradient of the phase that's relevant for zeta 2 becomes non-trivial. And what you find if you do a numerical evaluation is that zeta 2 changes in this funny way when those guys overlap. And as soon as they stop overlapping and they're moved beyond one another, it becomes stationary again, right? Because now it's, again, only influenced by one of those wave functions. So this is like Michael's example with, you know, the atom that's done a transition of levels. Initially, it's stationary. After the transition, it's stationary. But during the transition, it moves around in a way that depends on the entire wave function. So this is the failure of local causality within this model. It says that my choice of whether to put a mirror here far away can instantaneously affect the dynamics of the Bohmian particle over there. The statistics don't change. Turns out if you ask, well, what's the probability of finding that Bohmian particle in any region, it consistently maintains this profile, right? And so I can't use this to signal, because statistically speaking, I get the same results. But at the hidden level, there's a change. And this is what's critical for Bell's theorem. This is how you explain the correlations in Bell's theorem within the de Broglie-Bohm interpretation. Yes?
The log in, like, can you set the, the system up and then let the first particle get arbitrarily far away and then kind of throw a log in front of it and have it still have a non-local interaction?
Yep. It doesn't matter how long you wait. The point is that if you can cause these two parts of the wave function to re-interfere, then you can influence the dynamics of this particle. So you just make phi A and phi B overlap again. Chi A and chi B have overlap by virtue of how I've chosen them. So all I need to do is make phi A and phi B overlap, and then these two waves interfere, and that influences the dynamics. Yeah?
Sorry if this is a bit stupid, but what keeps you, a la Heisenberg, uncertainty of just picking it, of somehow preparing this in ontic state with a known Bohmian position so that your statistics become tighter than if you prepare just the wave function?
Yeah.
You could use that super limited signal, right?
Yeah. Well, the situation is that initially, let's assume that we're not talking about Antony Valentini's case, but we have a standard distribution. And you say, right, now I want to get a non-standard distribution. How do I do that? Well, let's say I turn on some potentials in my lab. Well, the theorem we proved earlier was that if I start in a standard distribution, I end in a standard distribution according to the dynamics. So as long as I'm doing things that are allowed by standard quantum theory, I never get out of that standard distribution. I can never narrow it down. Of course, if Antony Valentini is right, you know, he would argue that perhaps there are some exotic sources of quantum matter in the universe that have not had time to achieve quantum equilibrium. So this mixing that's necessary hasn't happened to them. So he's postulating, you know, perhaps near black holes or in the cosmic microwave background, you might find such quantum matter. And then maybe it would be distributed in a different way, and you could start using it for these kinds of exotic purposes. And Scott Aronson has written some papers, I think Scott has written some papers on what you could do with this kind of matter. Maybe it was somebody else. I'm not sure. But yeah, people have talked about the information theoretic power of matter that's known to be distributed in a way different from the standard distribution. Yes?
So I guess for people who like special relativity and like this realist Bohm interpretation, you need to have some way that, like, it's a hidden variable theory where the hidden variables are actually fundamentally cloaked in some way that you can never find them out. Like, I guess with some other ones, maybe like they're hidden, but like maybe you could somehow find them out and things like that. But is like the standard distribution being propagated along by the wave function by Schrödinger's equation the thing that hides it forever?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah.
On that same vein, what keeps you from ever measuring if I, because if we don't have some mechanism for measurement evolving your Bohmian position into a new unknown state, then you could just repeat your measurement over and over again until you get tighter and tighter bounds on the position.
Right.
And then you don't care if it's according to a standard distribution, you know it exactly.
Yeah. Okay, we'll talk next time about measurement theory in both Broglie-Bohm. Let me stop there for today and we can take these questions again next time.